supplements, they don't seem to work at all. Indeed, in the case of beta-carotene ingested as a supplement, scientists have discovered that it actually increases the risk of certain cancers. Big oops. What's going on here? We don't know. It could be the vagaries of human digestion. Maybe the fiber or some other component in a carrot protects the antioxidant molecule from destruction by stomach acids early in the digestive process. Or it could be we isolated the wrong antioxidant. Beta is just one of a whole slew of carotenes found in common vegetables. Maybe we focused on the wrong one. Or maybe beta-carotene works as an antioxidant only in concert with some other plant, chemical, or process. Under other circumstances, it may behave as a pro-oxidant. Indeed, to look at the chemical composition of any common food plant is to realize just how much complexity lurks within it. Here's a list of just the antioxidants that have been identified in a leaf of garden variety thyme. Alanine, anethol essential oil, apigenin, ascorbic acid, beta-carotene, caffeic acid, camphene, carvacrol, chlorogenic acid, chrysoaerial, durolic acid, ariadictiol, eugenol, 4-terpenol, gallic acid, gamma-terpeninim, isochlorogenic acid, isoeugenol, isothymonin, camphorol, labiatic acid, lauric acid, linalyl acetate, luteolin, methionine, myrcene, myristic acid, naringenin, rosmarinic acid, selenium, tannin, thymol, tryptophan, ursolic acid, vanillic acid. This is what you're ingesting when you eat food flavored with thyme. Some of these chemicals are broken down by your digestion, but others go on to do various, as yet undetermined, things to your body, turning some gene's expression on or off, perhaps, or heading off a free radical before it disturbs a strand of DNA deep in some cell. It would be great to know how this all works, but in the meantime, we can enjoy thyme in the knowledge that it probably doesn't do any harm, because people have been eating it forever, and that it might actually do some good, because people have been eating it forever, and even if it does nothing at all, we like the way it tastes. It's important also to remind ourselves that what reductive science can manage to perceive well enough to isolate and study is subject to almost continual change, and that we have a tendency to assume that what we can see is the important thing to look at. The vast attention paid to cholesterol since the 1950s is largely the result of the fact that cholesterol was the only factor linked to heart disease that we had the tools to measure. This is sometimes called parking lot science, after the legendary fellow who loses his keys in a parking lot and goes looking for them under the streetlight. Not because that's where he lost them, but because that's where it's easiest to see. When we figured out how to measure different types of cholesterol, and then triglycerides and C-reactive protein, those became the important components to look at. There will no doubt be other factors as yet unidentified. It's an old story. When Prout and Liebig nailed down the macronutrients, scientists figured that they now understood the nature of food and what the body needed from it. Then, when the vitamins were isolated a few decades later, scientists thought, okay, now we really understand food and what the body needs for its health. And today, it's the polyphenols and carotenoids that seem to have completed the picture. But who knows what the hell else is going on deep in the soul of a carrot. The good news is that, to the carrot eater, it doesn't matter. That's the great thing about eating foods as compared with nutrients. You don't need to fathom a carrot's complexity in order to reap its benefits. The mystery of the antioxidants points up the danger in taking a nutrient out of the context of food. Scientists make a second related error when they attempt to study the food out of the context of the diet. We eat foods in combinations and in orders that can affect how they're metabolized. The carbohydrates in a bagel will be absorbed more slowly if the bagel is spread with peanut butter. The fiber, fat, and protein in the peanut butter cushion the insulin response, thereby blunting the impact of the carbohydrates on the metabolism. This is why eating dessert at the end of the meal rather than the beginning is a good idea. Drink coffee with your steak and your body won't be able to fully absorb the iron in the meat. The olive oil with which I eat tomatoes makes the lycopene they contain more available to my body. Some of those compounds in that sprig of thyme may affect my digestion of the dish I add it to, helping to break down one compound or stimulate production of an enzyme needed to detoxify another. We have barely begun to understand the relationships among foods in a cuisine. But we do understand some of the simplest relationships among foods, like the zero-sum relationship. If you eat a lot of one thing, you're probably not eating a lot of something else. This fact alone may have helped lead the diet heart researchers astray. Like most of us, they assumed that a bad outcome, like heart disease, must have a bad cause, like saturated fat or cholesterol, and so they focused their investigative energies on how these bad nutrients might cause disease, rather than on how the absence of something else, like plant foods or fish, might figure in the etiology of the disease. Nutrition science has usually put more of its energies into the idea that the problems it studies are the result of too much of a bad thing, instead of too little of a good thing. Is this good science or nutritionist prejudice? The epidemiologist John Powles has suggested this predilection is little more than a Puritan bias. Bad things happen to people who eat bad things. But what people don't eat may matter as much as what they do. This fact could explain why populations that eat diets containing lots of animal food generally have higher rates of coronary heart disease and cancer than those that don't. But nutritionism encouraged researchers to look beyond the possibly culpable food itself, meat, to the culpable nutrient in the meat, which scientists have long assumed to be the saturated fat. So they are baffled indeed when large dietary trials like the Women's Health Initiative and the Nurses' Health Study fail to find evidence that reducing fat intake significantly reduces the incidence of heart disease or cancer. Of course, thanks to the low-fat diet fad, inspired by the very same reductionist hypothesis about fat, it is entirely possible to slash your intake of saturated fat without greatly reducing your consumption of animal protein. Just drink the low-fat milk, buy the low-fat cheese, and order the chicken breast or the turkey bacon instead of the burger. So did the big dietary trials exonerate meat or just fat? Unfortunately, the focus on nutrients didn't tell us much about food. Perhaps the culprit nutrient in meat and dairy is the animal protein itself, as some researchers hypothesize. The Cornell nutritionist T. Colin Campbell argues as much in his recent book, The China Study. Others think it could be the particular kind of iron in red meat, called heme iron, or the nitrosamines produced when meat is cooked. Perhaps, as Walter C. Willett suggests, it is the steroid growth hormones typically present in the milk and meat. These hormones, which occur naturally in meat and milk but are often augmented in industrial production, are known to promote certain kinds of cancer. Or, as I mentioned, the problem with a meat-heavy diet might not even be the meat itself, but the plants that all that meat has pushed off the plate. We just don't know. But eaters worried about their health needn't wait for science to settle this question before deciding that it might be wise to eat more plants and less meat. This, of course, is precisely what the McGovern Committee had originally tried to tell us. The zero-sum fallacy of nutrition science poses another obstacle to nailing down the effect of a single nutrient. As Gary Taubes points out, it's difficult to design a dietary trial of something like saturated fat because as soon as you remove it from the diet, either you have dramatically reduced the calories in that diet or you have replaced the saturated fat with something else. Other fats, but which ones? Or carbohydrates, but what kind? Or protein? Whatever you do, you've introduced a second variable into the experiment, so you will not be able to attribute any observed effect strictly to the absence of saturated fat. It could just as easily be due to the reduction in calories, or the addition of carbohydrates, or polyunsaturated fats. For every diet hypothesis you test, you can construct an alternative hypothesis based on the presence or absence of the substitute nutrient. It gets messy. And then there is the placebo effect, which has always bedeviled nutrition research. About a third of Americans are what researchers call responders, people who will respond to a treatment or intervention regardless of whether they've actually received it. When testing a drug, you can correct for this by using a placebo in your trial. But how do you correct for the placebo effect in the case of a dietary trial? You can't. Low-fat foods seldom taste like the real thing, and no person is ever going to confuse a meal of meat for a vegetarian substitute. Marion Nestle also cautions against taking the diet out of the context of the lifestyle, a particular hazard when comparing the diets of different populations. The Mediterranean diet is widely believed to be one of the most healthful of traditional diets, yet much of what we know about it is based on studies in the 1950s of people living on the island of Crete, who in many respects led lives very different from our own. Yes, they ate lots of olive oil and more fish than meat, but they also did more physical labor. They fasted regularly. They ate lots of wild greens, weeds. And perhaps most significant, they ate far fewer total calories than we do. Similarly, much of what we know about the health benefits of a vegetarian diet is based on studies of Seventh-day Adventists, who muddy the nutritional picture by abstaining from alcohol and tobacco as well as meat. These extraneous but unavoidable factors are called, aptly, confounders. One last example. People who take supplements are healthier than the population at large, yet their health probably has nothing whatsoever to do with the supplements they take, most of which recent studies have suggested are worthless. Supplement takers tend to be better educated, more affluent people who almost by definition take a greater than normal interest in personal health. Confounders that probably account for their superior health. But if confounding factors of lifestyle bedevil epidemiological comparisons of different populations, the supposedly more rigorous studies of large American populations suffer from their own arguably even more disabling flaws. In ascending order of supposed reliability, nutrition researchers have three main methods for studying the impact of diet on health: the case control study, the cohort study, and the intervention trial. All three are seriously flawed in different ways. In the case control study, researchers attempt to determine the diet of a subject who has been diagnosed with a chronic disease in order to uncover its cause. One problem is that when people get sick, they may change the way they eat, so the diet they report may not be the diet responsible for their illness. The other problem is that these patients will typically report eating large amounts of whatever the evil nutrient of the moment is. These people read the newspaper, too. It's only natural to search for the causes of one's misfortune and, perhaps, to link illness to one's behavior. One of the more pernicious aspects of nutritionism is that it encourages us to blame our health problems on lifestyle choices, implying that the individual bears ultimate responsibility for whatever illnesses befall him. It's worth keeping in mind that a far more powerful predictor of heart disease than either diet or exercise is social class. Long-term observational studies of cohort groups, such as the Nurses' Health Study, represent a big step up in reliability from the case control study. For one thing, the studies are prospective rather than retrospective. They begin tracking subjects before they become ill. The Nurses' Study, which has collected data on the eating habits and health outcomes of more than 100,000 women over several decades, at a cost of more than $100 million, is considered the best study of its kind, yet it too has limitations. One is its reliance on food frequency questionnaires, about which more in a moment. Another is the population of nurses it has chosen to study. Critics, notably Colin Campbell, point out that the sample is relatively uniform and is even more carnivorous than the U.S. population as a whole. Pretty much everyone in the group eats a Western diet. This means that when researchers divide the subject population into groups, typically fifths, to test the impact of, say, a low-fat diet, the quintile eating the lowest-fat diet is not all that low, or so dramatically different from the quintile consuming the highest-fat diet. Virtually this entire cohort of nurses is consuming a high-risk diet, according to Campbell. That might explain why the Nurses' Study has failed to detect significant benefits for a great many of the dietary interventions it's looked at. In a subject population that is eating a fairly standard Western diet, as this one is, you're never going to capture the effects, good or bad, of more radically different ways of eating. In his book, Campbell reports Walter Willett's personal response to this criticism. "You may be right, Colin, but people don't want to go there." The so-called gold standard in nutrition research is the large-scale intervention study. In these studies, of which the Women's Health Initiative is the biggest and best known, a large population is divided into two groups. The intervention group changes its diet in some prescribed way, while the control group, one hopes, does not. The two groups are then tracked over many years to learn whether the intervention affects relative rates of chronic disease. In the case of the Women's Health Initiative study of dietary fat, a $415 million undertaking sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, the eating habits and health outcomes of nearly 49,000 women aged 50 to 79 were tracked for 8 years to assess the impact of a low-fat diet on a woman's risk of breast and colorectal cancer and cardiovascular disease. 40% of the women were told to reduce their consumption of fat to 20% of total calories. When the results were announced in 2006, it made front-page news. The New York Times headline said, "Low-fat diet does not cut health risks, study finds." And the cloud of nutritional confusion beneath which Americans endeavor to eat darkened further. Even a cursory examination of the study's methods makes you wonder what, if anything, it proved, either about dietary fat or meat eating. You could argue that, like the Nurses' Health Study, all any such trials prove is that changing one component in the diet at a time, and not by much, does not confer a significant health benefit. But perhaps the strongest conclusion that can be drawn from an analysis of the Women's Health Initiative is about the inherent limitations of this kind of nutrient-by-nutrient nutrition research. Even the beginning student of nutritionism will immediately spot several flaws. The focus was on dietary fat rather than on any particular food, such as meat or dairy. So women could reach their goal simply by switching to lower-fat animal products. Also, no distinctions were made between different types of fat. Women getting their allowable portion of fat from olive oil or fish were lumped together with women getting their fat from low-fat cheese or chicken breasts or margarine. Why? Because when the study was designed 16 years ago, the whole notion of good fats was not yet on the mainstream scientific scope. Scientists study what scientists can see. Another problem with the trial was that the low-fat group failed to hit the 20% target. The best they could manage was 24% in the first year, but by the end of the study, they'd drifted back to 29%, only a few percentage points lower than the control group's fat intake, which was itself drifting downward, as the women allowed to eat as much fat as they wanted, presumably read the newspapers and the food product labels, and absorbed the culture's enthusiasm for all things low fat. This corruption of a control group by popular dietary advice is called the treatment effect. So it's hardly surprising that the health outcomes of the two groups would not greatly differ. By the end, they might have been consuming pretty much the same diet. I say might have been because we actually have little idea what these women were really eating. Like most people asked about their diet, they lied about it. Which brings us to what is perhaps the single biggest problem in doing nutrition science. Even the scientists who conduct this sort of research conduct it in the knowledge that people underestimate, to be generous, their food intake all the time. They have even developed scientific figures for the magnitude of the underestimate. Validation studies of dietary trials like the Women's Health Initiative or the Nurses Study, which rely on food frequency questionnaires filled out by subjects several times a year, indicate that people on average eat between a fifth and a third more than they say they do on questionnaires. In fact, the magnitude of the lie could be much greater, judging by the huge disparity between the total number of food calories produced every day for each American, 3,900, and the average number of those calories Americans own up to chomping each day, 2,000. Waste can account for some of this disparity, but not nearly all of it. How do the researchers know that? By comparing what people report on their food frequency questionnaires with interviews about their dietary intake over the previous 24 hours, thought to be somewhat more reliable. Somewhat. Because as you might expect, these 24-hour recall data have their own accuracy problems. How typical of your overall diet is what you ate during any single 24-hour period? To try to fill out the food frequency questionnaire used by the Women's Health Initiative, as I recently did, is to realize just how shaky the data on which all such dietary studies rely really are. The survey, which takes about 45 minutes to complete, starts off with some relatively easy questions. Did you eat chicken or turkey during the last 3 months? Having answered yes, I then was asked, when you ate chicken or turkey, how often did you eat the skin? And did you usually choose light meat, dark meat, both? But the survey soon became harder, as when it asked me to think back over the past 3 months to recall whether when I ate okra, squash, or yams, were they fried, and if so, were they fried in stick margarine, tub margarine, butter, shortening, in which category they inexplicably lumped together hydrogenated vegetable oil and lard, olive or canola oil, or non-stick spray. I would hope they'd take my answers with a grain of salt, because I honestly didn't remember, and in the case of any okra eaten in a restaurant, even a hypnotist or CIA interrogator could not extract from me what sort of fat it was fried in. Now that we spend half of our food dollars on meals prepared outside of the home, how can respondents possibly know what type of fats they're consuming? Matters got even dicier in the second section of the survey when I was asked to specify how many times in the last 3 months I'd eaten a half-cup serving of broccoli, among a dizzying array of other fruits and vegetables I was asked to tally for the dietary quarter. I'm not sure Marcel Proust himself could recall his dietary intake over the last 90 days with the sort of precision demanded by the FFQ. When you get to the meat section, the portion sizes specified haven't been seen in America since the Hoover administration. If a 4-ounce portion of steak is considered medium, was I really going to admit that the steak I enjoyed on an unrecallable number of occasions during the past 3 months was probably the equivalent of 2 or 3, or in the case of a steakhouse steak, no fewer than 4 of these portions? I think not. In fact, most of the medium serving sizes to which I was asked to compare my own consumption made me feel like such a pig that I sorely wanted to shave a few ounces here, a few there. I mean, I wasn't under oath or anything. These are the sort of data on which the largest questions of diet and health are being decided today. The most intellectually demanding challenge in the field of nutrition, as Marion Nestle writes in Food Politics, is to determine dietary intake. The uncomfortable fact is that the entire field of nutritional science rests on a foundation of ignorance and lies about the most basic question of nutrition. What are people eating? Over lunch, I asked Nestle if I was perhaps being too harsh. She smiled. To really know what a person is eating, you'd have to have a second invisible person following them around, taking photographs, looking at ingredients, and consulting accurate food composition tables, which we don't have. When you report on an FFQ that you ate a carrot, the tabulator consults a U.S. Department of Agriculture database to determine exactly how much calcium or beta-carotene that carrot contained. But because all carrots are not created equal, their nutrient content varying with everything from the variety planted and type of soil it was planted in to the agriculture system used, organic, conventional, and the carrot's freshness, these tables suffer from their own inaccuracies. I was beginning to realize just how much suspension of disbelief it takes to be a nutrition scientist. It's impossible, Nestle continued. Are people unconsciously underestimating consumption of things they think the researcher thinks are bad, or overestimating consumption of things they think the researcher thinks are good? We don't know. Probably both. The issue of reporting is extraordinarily serious. We have to ask, how accurate are the data? It's not as though the epidemiologists who develop and deploy FFQs are unaware of their limitations. Some of them, like Walter Willett, strive heroically to repair the faulty data, developing energy adjustment factors to correct for the fact that the calories reported on surveys are invariably wrong, and complicated measurement error algorithms to fix the errors in the 24-hour recall surveys used to fix the errors in the FFQ. I tracked down Gladys Block, the prominent epidemiologist who developed the FFQ on which the Women's Health Initiative based its own questionnaire. We met for coffee in Berkeley, where she is a professor in the School of Public Health. Nearing retirement, Block is unusually thoughtful about the limits of her field and disarmingly candid. It's a mess, she said, speaking not of the FFQ itself, but of the various formulae and algorithms being used to correct errors in the data. Because if the energy, i.e. the reported calorie consumption, is off, then the nutrients are off too. So if you're going to correct for calories, do you then also correct for... She paused. No. It's a mess. Block thinks the problem with nutrition science, which she feels has led us astray, is not the FFQ itself, but mis- and over-interpretation of the data derived from the FFQ, a tool for which she makes realistic but strikingly modest claims. The real purpose of the FFQ is to rank people on their relative consumption of, say, fruits and vegetables or total calories. If someone reports consuming 500 calories a day, that's not true, obviously, but you can say they're probably at the low end of the spectrum. People over-worry about accuracy. This was not the sort of thing I ever expected to hear from an epidemiologist. But then, neither was this. I don't believe anything I read in nutritional epidemiology anymore. I'm so skeptical at this point. Nutritionism's Children. So where does this leave us eaters? More confused about how to eat than any people in history would be my strictly unscientific conclusion. Actually, there is some science, admittedly a little soft, which has captured a bit of the confusion that the supposedly harder science of nutrition has sown in the American mind. Paul Rozin is a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania who has dreamed up some of the more imaginative survey questions ever asked of American eaters. The answers he's collected offer a pretty good index to our current befuddlement and anxiety about eating. He has found, for example, that half of us believe high-calorie foods eaten in small amounts contain more calories than low-calorie foods eaten in much larger amounts, and that a third of us believe that a diet absolutely free of fat, a nutrient, lest you forget, essential to our survival, would be better for us than a diet containing even just a pinch of it. In one experiment, he showed the words chocolate cake to a group of Americans and recorded their word associations. Guilt was the top response. If that strikes you as unexceptional, consider the response of the French eaters to the same prompt. Celebration. Oh, yeah. I think of Rozin as a kind of psychoanalyst of nutritionism. A few years ago, Rozin presented a group of Americans with the following scenario. Assume you are alone on a desert island for 1 year, and you can have water and one other food. Pick the food that you think would be best for your health. The choices were corn, alfalfa sprouts, hot dogs, spinach, peaches, bananas, and milk chocolate. The most popular choice was bananas, 42%, followed by spinach, 27%, corn, 12%, alfalfa sprouts, 7%, peaches, 5%, hot dogs, 4%, and milk chocolate, 3%. Only 7% of the participants chose one of the two foods that would, in fact, best support survival, hot dogs and milk chocolate. Evidently, some of the wreckage of the lipid hypothesis has washed up on Rozin's desert island. Fat, he writes, seems to have assumed, even at low levels, the role of a toxin in our dietary imaginations. I wonder why. As Rozin points out, worrying so much about food can't be very good for your health. Indeed. Orthorexia nervosa is an eating disorder not yet recognized by the DSM-IV, but some psychologists have recently suggested that it's time it was. They're seeing more and more patients suffering from an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. So this is what putting science and scientism in charge of the American diet has gotten us. Anxiety and confusion about even the most basic questions of food and health, and a steadily diminishing ability to enjoy one of the great pleasures of life without guilt or neurosis. But while nutritionism has its roots in a scientific approach to food, it's important to remember that it is not a science but an ideology, and that the food industry, journalism, and government bear just as much responsibility for its conquest of our minds and diets. All three helped to amplify the signal of nutritionism. Journalism, by uncritically reporting the latest dietary studies on its front pages. The food industry, by marketing dubious food-like products on the basis of tenuous health claims. And the government, by taking it upon itself to issue official dietary advice based on sketchy science in the first place, and corrupted by political pressure in the second. the novel food products the industry designed according to the latest nutritionist specs certainly helped push real food off our plates. But the industry's influence would not be nearly so great had the ideology of nutritionism not already undermined the influence of tradition and habit and common sense, and the transmitter of all those values, Mom, on our eating. Now, all this might be tolerable if eating by the light of nutritionism made us, if not happier, then at least healthier. That it has failed to do. 30 years of nutritional advice have left us fatter, sicker, and more poorly nourished, which is why we find ourselves in the predicament we do, in need of a whole new way to think about eating. Part 2. The Western Diet and the Diseases of Civilization. The Aborigine in All of Us. In the summer of 1982, a group of 10 middle-aged, overweight, and diabetic Aborigines living in settlements near the town of Derby, Western Australia, agreed to participate in an experiment to see if temporarily reversing the process of westernization they had undergone might also reverse their health problems. Since leaving the bush some years before, all 10 had developed type 2 diabetes. They also showed signs of insulin resistance, when the body's cells lose their sensitivity to insulin, and elevated levels of triglycerides in the blood, a risk factor for heart disease. Metabolic syndrome, or Syndrome X, is the medical term for the complex of health problems these Aborigines had developed. Large amounts of refined carbohydrates in the diet, combined with a sedentary lifestyle, had disordered the intricate and still imperfectly understood system by which the insulin hormone regulates the metabolism of carbohydrates and fats in the body. Metabolic syndrome has been implicated not only in the development of type 2 diabetes, but also in obesity, hypertension, heart disease, and possibly certain cancers. Some researchers believe that metabolic syndrome may be at the root of many of the diseases of civilization that typically follow a native population's adoption of a Western lifestyle and the nutrition transition that typically entails. The 10 Aborigines returned to their traditional homeland, an isolated region of northwest Australia more than a day's drive by off-road vehicle from the nearest town. From the moment they left civilization, the group had no access to store food or beverages. The idea was for the members to rely exclusively on foods they hunted and gathered themselves. Even while living in town, they still occasionally hunted traditional foods, and so had preserved the knowledge of how to do so. Karen O'Day, the nutrition researcher who designed the experiment, accompanied the group to monitor and record its dietary intake and keep tabs on the members' health. The Aborigines divided their 7-week stay in the bush between a coastal and an inland location. While on the coast, their diet consisted mainly of seafood, supplemented by birds, kangaroo, and witchetty grubs, the fatty larvae of a local insect. Hoping to find more plant foods, the group moved inland after 2 weeks, settling at a riverside location. Here, in addition to freshwater fish and shellfish, its diet expanded to include turtle, crocodile, birds, kangaroo, yams, figs, and bush honey. The contrast between this hunter-gatherer fare and the previous diet was stark. O'Day reports that prior to the experiment, the main dietary components in the urban setting were flour, sugar, rice, carbonated drinks, alcoholic beverages, beer and port, powdered milk, cheap fatty meat, potatoes, onions, and variable contributions of other fresh fruits and vegetables. The local version of the Western diet. After 7 weeks in the bush, O'Day drew blood from the Aborigines and found striking improvements in virtually every measure of their health. All had lost weight, an average of 17.9 pounds, and seen their blood pressure drop. Their triglyceride levels had fallen into the normal range. The proportion of omega-3 fatty acids in their tissues had increased dramatically. In summary, O'Day wrote, all of the metabolic abnormalities of type 2 diabetes were either greatly improved, glucose tolerance, insulin response to glucose, or completely normalized, plasma lipids, in a group of diabetic aborigines by a relatively short 7-week reversion to traditional hunter-gatherer lifestyle. O'Day does not report what happened next, whether the aborigines elected to remain in the bush or return to civilization, but it's safe to assume that if they did return to their Western lifestyles, their health problems returned too. We have known for at least a century now that there is a complex of so-called Western diseases, including obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and a specific set of diet-related cancers, that begin almost invariably to appear soon after a people abandons its traditional diet and way of life. What we did not know before O'Day took her aborigines back to the bush, and since she did, a series of comparable experiments have produced similar results in Native Americans and Native Hawaiians, was that some of the most deleterious effects of the Western diet could be so quickly reversed. It appears that, at least to an extent, we can rewind the tape of the nutrition transition and undo some of its damage. The implications for our own health are potentially significant. The genius of Karen O'Day's experiment was its simplicity, and her refusal to let herself be drawn into the scientific labyrinth of nutritionism. She did not attempt to pick out from the complexity of the diet, either before or after the experiment, which one factor might explain the results. Whether it was the low-fat diet, or the absence of refined carbohydrates, or the reduction in total calories, or the increase in exercise that was responsible for the improvement in the group's health. Her focus instead was on larger dietary patterns, and while this approach has its limitations, we can't extract from such a study precisely which component of the Western diet we need to adjust in order to blunt its worst effects, it has the great virtue of escaping the welter of conflicting theories about specific nutrients and returning our attention to more fundamental questions about the links between diet and health. Like this one. To what extent are we all aborigines? When you consider that 2/3 of Americans are overweight or obese, that fully 1/4 of us have metabolic syndrome, that 54 million have pre-diabetes, and that the incidence of type 2 diabetes has risen 5% annually since 1990, going from 4% to 7.7% of the adult population, that's more than 20 million Americans. The question is not nearly as silly as it sounds. The elephant in the room. In the end, even the biggest, most ambitious, and widely reported studies of diet and health, the Nurses' Health Study, the Women's Health Initiative, and nearly all the others, leave more or less undisturbed the main features of the Western diet. Lots of processed foods and meat, lots of added fat and sugar, lots of everything except fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. In keeping with the nutritionism paradigm and the limits of reductionist science, most nutrition researchers fiddle with single nutrients as best they can, but the populations they recruit and study are typical American eaters doing what typical American eaters do. Trying to eat a little less of this nutrient, a little more of that one, depending on the latest thinking. But the overall dietary pattern is treated as a more or less unalterable given. Which is why it probably should not surprise us that the findings of such research should be so modest, equivocal, and confusing. But what about the elephant in the room? This pattern of eating that we call the Western diet. In the midst of our deepening confusion about nutrition, it might be useful to step back and gaze upon it. Review what we do know about the Western diet and its effects on our health. What we know is that people who eat the way we do in the West today suffer substantially higher rates of cancer, cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, and obesity than people eating any number of different traditional diets. We also know that when people come to the West and adopt our way of eating, these diseases soon follow, and often, as in the case of the Aborigines and other native populations, in a particularly virulent form. The outlines of this story, the story of the so-called Western diseases and their link to the Western diet, we first learned in the early decades of the 20th century. That was when a handful of dauntless European and American medical professionals, working with a wide variety of native populations around the world, began noticing the almost complete absence of the chronic diseases that had become commonplace in the West. Albert Schweitzer and Dennis P. Burkitt in Africa, Robert McCarrison in India, Samuel Hutton among the Eskimos in Labrador, the anthropologist Alice Herdlichke among Native Americans, and the Canadian-born dentist Weston A. Price among a dozen different groups all over the world, including Peruvian Indians, Australian Aborigines, and Swiss mountaineers, sent back much the same news. They compiled lists, many of which appeared in medical journals, of the common diseases they'd been hard-pressed to find in the native populations they had treated or studied. Little to no heart disease, diabetes, cancer, obesity, hypertension, or stroke. No appendicitis, diverticulitis, malformed dental arches, or tooth decay. No varicose veins, ulcers, or hemorrhoids. These disorders suddenly appeared to these researchers under a striking new light, as was captured by the new name given to them by the British doctor Dennis Burkitt, who was working in Africa during World War II. He proposed that we call them Western diseases. The implication was that these very different sorts of diseases were somehow linked and might even share a common cause. Several of these researchers were on hand to witness the arrival of the Western diseases in isolated populations, typically, as Albert Schweitzer wrote, among natives living more and more after the manner of the whites. Some noted that the Western diseases followed closely on the heels of the arrival of Western foods, particularly refined flour and sugar and other kinds of store food. They observed, too, that when one Western disease arrived on the scene, so did most of the others, and often in the same order. Obesity, followed by type 2 diabetes, followed by hypertension and stroke, followed by heart disease. In the years before World War II, the medical world entertained a lively conversation on the subject of the Western diseases and what their rise might say about our increasingly industrialized way of life. The concepts pioneers believed there were novelties in the modern diet to which native populations were poorly adapted, though they did not necessarily agree on exactly which novelty might be the culprit. Burkitt, for example, believed it was the lack of fiber in the modern diet, while McCarrison, a British Army doctor, focused on refined carbohydrates, while still others blamed meat-eating and saturated fat, or, in Price's case, the advent of processed food and industrially grown crops deficient in vitamins and minerals. Not everyone, though, bought into the idea that chronic disease was a byproduct of Western lifestyles, and, in particular, that the industrialization of our food was taking a toll on our health. One objection to the theory was genetic. Different races were apt to be susceptible to different diseases, went the argument. White people were disposed to heart attacks, brown people to things like leprosy. Yet, as Burkitt and others pointed out, blacks living in America suffered from the same chronic diseases as whites living there. Simply by moving to places like America, immigrants from nations with low rates of chronic disease seemed to quickly acquire them. The other objection to the concept of Western diseases, one you sometimes still hear, was demographic. The reason we see so much chronic disease in the West is because these are illnesses that appear relatively late in life. And with the conquest of infectious disease early in the 20th century, we are simply living long enough to get them. In this view, chronic disease is the inevitable price of a long life. But while it is true that our life expectancy has improved dramatically since 1900, rising in the U.S. from 49 to 77 years, most of that gain is attributed to the fact that more of us are surviving infancy and childhood. The life expectancy of a 65-year-old in 1900 was only about 6 years less than that of a 65-year-old living today. It may be that the explosion of chronic diseases during the 20th century is now taking a toll on American life expectancy. In 2007, the CIA World Factbook ranked the U.S. 45th for life expectancy at birth, below countries like Israel, Jordan, Bosnia, and Bermuda. Future gains in life expectancy depend largely on how much we can extend life among the elderly. Exceedingly difficult when you consider that the incidence of diabetes in people over 75 is projected to increase 336% during the first half of this century. When you adjust for age, rates of chronic diseases like cancer and type 2 diabetes are considerably higher today than they were in 1900. That is, the chances that a 60 or 70-year-old suffers from cancer or type 2 diabetes are far greater today than they were a century ago. The same may well be true of heart disease, but because heart disease statistics from 1900 are so sketchy, we can't be sure. Cancer and heart disease and so many of the other Western diseases are by now such an accepted part of modern life that it's hard for us to believe this wasn't always or even necessarily the case. These days, most of us think of chronic diseases as being a little like the weather, one of life's givens, and so count ourselves lucky that, compared to the weather, the diseases are at least more amenable to intervention by modern medicine. We think of them strictly in medical rather than historical, much less evolutionary terms. But during the decades before World War II, when the industrialization of so many aspects of our lives was still fairly fresh, the price of progress, especially to our health, seemed more obvious to many people and therefore more open to question. One of the most intrepid questioners of the pre-war period was Weston A. Price, who became preoccupied with one of those glaring questions we can't even see anymore. Much like heart disease, chronic problems of the teeth are by now part of the furniture of modern life. But if you stop to think about it, it is odd that everyone should need a dentist, and that so many of us should need braces, root canals, extractions of wisdom teeth, and all the other routine procedures of mouth maintenance. Could the need for so much remedial work on a body part crucially involved in an activity as critical to our survival as eating reflect a design defect in the human body, some sort of oversight of natural selection? This seems unlikely. Weston Price, who was born in 1870 in a farming community south of Ottawa and built a dental practice in Cleveland, Ohio, had personally witnessed the rapid increase in dental problems beginning around the turn of the last century and was convinced that the cause could be found in the modern diet. He wasn't the only one. In the 1930s, an argument raged in medical circles as to whether hygiene or nutrition was the key to understanding and treating tooth decay. A public debate on that very question in Manhattan in 1934 attracted an overflow audience of thousands. That hygiene ultimately won the day had as much to do with the needs of the dental profession as it did with good science. The problem of personal hygiene was easier and far more profitable to address than that of the diet and entire food system. In the 1930s, Price closed down his dental practice so he could devote all his energies to solving the mystery of the Western diet. He went looking for what he called control groups, isolated populations that had not yet been exposed to modern foods. He found them in the mountains of Switzerland and Peru, the lowlands of Africa, the bush of Australia, the outer islands of the Hebrides, the Everglades of Florida, the coast of Alaska, the islands of Melanesia and the Torres Strait, and the jungles of New Guinea and New Zealand, among other places. Price made some remarkable discoveries, which he wrote up in articles for medical journals, with titles like New Light on Modern Physical Degeneration from Field Studies Among Primitive Races, and ultimately summarized in his 510-page tome, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, published in 1939. Although his research was taken seriously during his lifetime, Weston Price has been all but written out of the history of 20th century science. The single best account I could find of his life and work is an unpublished master's thesis by Martin Renner, a graduate student in history at UC Santa Cruz. This neglect might owe to the fact that Price was a dentist and more of an amateur scientist in the 19th century mode than a professional medical researcher. It might also be because he could sometimes come across as a bit of a crackpot. One of his articles was titled Dentistry and Race Destiny. His discussions of primitive races are off-putting to say the least, though he ended up a harsh critic of modern civilization, convinced his primitives had more to teach us than the other way around. He was also something of a monomaniac on the subject of diet, certain that poor nutrition could explain not just tooth decay and heart disease, but just about everything else that bedeviled humankind, including juvenile delinquency, the collapse of civilizations, and modern war. Still, the data he painstakingly gathered from his control groups and the lines of connection he was able to trace not only between diet and health, but also between the way a people produces food and its food's nutritional quality remain valuable today. Indeed, his research is even more valuable today than in 1939 because most of the groups he studied have long since vanished or adopted more Western ways of eating. If you want to study the Western diet today, control groups are few and far between. You can, of course, create them, as Karen O'Day did in Australia. Price's work also points the way toward a proto-ecological understanding of food that will be useful as we try to escape the traps of nutritionism. So what did Price learn? First, that isolated populations eating a wide variety of traditional diets had no need of dentists whatsoever. Well, almost no need of dentists. The sturdy mountaineers of Switzerland, who never saw a toothbrush, had teeth covered in a greenish slime. But underneath that, Price found perfectly formed teeth virtually free of decay. Wherever he found an isolated primitive race that had not yet encountered the displacing foods of modern commerce, by which he meant refined flour, sugar, canned and chemically preserved foods and vegetable oils, he found little or no evidence of modern degeneration, by which he meant chronic disease, tooth decay, and malformed dental arches. Either there was something present in the modern diet that led to these problems, or there was something absent from it. Wherever Price went, he took pictures of teeth and collected samples of food, which he sent home to Cleveland to be analyzed for macronutrient and vitamin content. He found that his native populations were eating a diet substantially higher in vitamins A and D than that of modern Americans. On average, 10 times as much. This owed partly to the fact that, as was already understood by the 1930s, the processing of foods typically robs them of nutrients, vitamins especially. Store food is food designed to be stored and transported over long distances, and the surest way to make food more stable and less vulnerable to pests is to remove the nutrients from it. In general, calories are much easier to transport in the form of refined grain or sugar than nutrients, which are liable to deteriorate or attract the attention of bacteria, insects, and rodents, all keenly interested in nutrients. More so, apparently, than we are. Price concluded that modern civilization had sacrificed much of the quality of its food in the interests of quantity and shelf life. Price identified no single ideal diet. He found populations that thrived on seafood diets, dairy diets, meat diets, and diets in which fruits, vegetables, and grain predominated. The Maasai of Africa consumed virtually no plant foods at all, subsisting on meat, blood, and milk. Seafaring groups in the Hebrides consumed no dairy at all, subsisting on a diet consisting